Mysticism and Logic. The attempt to conceive the world as a whole by means of thought has been developed, from the first, by the union and conflict of two very different human impulses, the one urging us towards mysticism, the other urging us towards science. Some people have achieved greatness through one of these impulses alone, others through the other alone. But the greatest have felt the need both of science and mysticism. The attempt to harmonize the two was what made their lives. Mysticism, in all ages and in all parts of the world, is characterized by certain beliefs. There is, first, the belief in insight as against discursive analytic knowledge, the belief in a way of wisdom, sudden, penetrating, coercive, which is contrasted with the slow and fallible study of outward appearance by a science relying wholly upon the senses. All who are capable of absorption in an inward passion must have experienced at times the strange feeling of unreality in common objects, the loss of contact with daily things, in which the solidity of the outer world is lost, and the soul seems, in utter loneliness, to bring forth, out of its own depths, the mad dance of fantastic phantoms, which have hitherto appeared as independently real and living. This is the negative side of the mystic's initiation, the doubt concerning common knowledge, preparing the way for the reception of what seems a higher wisdom. Many people to whom this negative experience is familiar do not pass beyond it. But for the mystic it is merely the gateway to an ampler world. The mystic insight begins with the sense of a mystery unveiled, of a hidden wisdom, now suddenly become certain beyond the possibility of a doubt. The sense of certainty and revelation comes earlier than any definite belief. The definite beliefs at which mystics arrive are the result of reflection upon the inarticulate experience gained in the moment of insight. Often, beliefs which have normal connection with this moment become subsequently attracted into the central nucleus. Thus, in addition to the convictions which all mystics share, we find in many of them other convictions of a more local and temporary character, which no doubt become amalgamated with what was essentially mystical in virtue of their subjective certainty. The first and most direct outcome of the moment of illumination is belief in the possibility of a way of knowledge which may be called revelation or insight or intuition, as contrasted with sense, reason, and analysis, which are regarded as blind guides leading to the morass of illusion. Closely connected with this belief is the conception of a reality behind the world of appearance and utterly different from it. This reality is regarded with an admiration, often amounting to worship. It is felt to be always and everywhere close at hand, thinly veiled by the shows of sense, ready for the receptive mind to shine in its glory even through the apparent folly and wickedness of humankind. The poet, the artist and the lover are seekers after that glory, but the haunting beauty that they pursue is the faint reflection of its sun. The mystic, however, lives in the full light of the vision. What others dimly seek, he knows. Of the reality of the mystic's world, I know nothing. I have no wish to deny it, nor even to declare that the insight which reveals it is not a genuine insight. What I do wish to maintain, and it is here that the scientific attitude becomes imperative, is that insight, untested and unsupported, is an insufficient guarantee of truth, in spite of the fact that much of the most important truth is first suggested by its means. It is common to speak of an opposition between instinct and reason, but in fact the opposition of instinct and reason is mainly illusory. Instinct, intuition or insight, is what first leads to the beliefs which subsequent reason confirms or confutes. But the confirmation, where it is possible, consists in the last analysis of agreement with other beliefs no less instinctive. Reason is a harmonizing, controlling force, rather than a creative one. Even in the most purely logical realm, it is insight that first arrives at what is new. Where instinct and reason do sometimes conflict is in regard to single beliefs, held instinctively and held with such determination that no degree of inconsistency with other beliefs leads to their abandonment. Instinct, like all human faculties, is liable to error. Those in whom reason is weak are often unwilling to admit this as regards themselves, though all admit it in regard to others. Where instinct is least liable to error is in practical matters as to which right judgment is a help to survival. Friendship and hostility in others, for instance, are often felt with extraordinary discrimination through very careful disguises. But even in such matters, a wrong impression may be given by reserve or flattery, and in matters less directly practical, such as philosophy deals with, very strong instinctive beliefs are sometimes wholly mistaken, as we may come to know through their perceived inconsistency with other equally strong beliefs. It is such considerations that necessitated the harmonizing mediation of reason, which tests our beliefs by their mutual compatibility, and examines, in doubtful cases, the possible sources of error on the one side and on the other. In this, there is no opposition to instinct as a whole, but only to blind reliance upon some one interesting aspect of instinct to the exclusion of other, more commonplace, but not less trustworthy aspects. It is such one-sidedness, not instinct itself, that reason aims at correcting. In advocating the scientific restraint and balance, as against the self-assertion of a confident reliance upon instinct and intuition, we are only urging, in the sphere of knowledge, that largeness of contemplation, that impersonal disinterestedness, and that freedom from practical preoccupations which have been inculcated by all the great religions of the world. Thus, our conclusion, however it may conflict with the explicit beliefs of many mystics, is, in essence, not contrary to the spirit which inspires those beliefs, but rather the outcome of this very spirit as applied in the realm of thought. One of the most convincing aspects of the mystic illumination is the apparent revelation of the oneness of all things. An elaborate logic, beginning with Parmenides, and culminating in Hegel and his followers, including Karl Marx, has been gradually developed to prove that the universe is one indivisible whole, and that what seems to be its parts, if considered as substantial and self-existing, are mere illusions. The conception of a reality quite other than the world of appearance, a reality one, indivisible and unchanging, was introduced into Western philosophy by Parmenides, not nominally at least for mystical or religious reasons, but on the basis of a logical argument as to the impossibility of not being. Most subsequent metaphysical systems are the outcome of this fundamental idea. Belief in a reality quite different from what appears to the senses arises with irresistible force in certain moods, which are the source of most mysticism and of most metaphysics. While such a mood is dominant, the need of logic is not felt, and accordingly the more thoroughgoing mystics do not employ logic, but appeal directly to the immediate deliverance of their insight. When the intensity of emotional conviction subsides, a person who is in the habit of reasoning will search for logical grounds in favor of the belief which he finds in himself. But since the belief already exists, he will be very hospitable to any ground that suggests itself. The paradoxes apparently proved by his logic are really the paradoxes of mysticism and are the goal which he feels his logic must reach if it is to be in accordance with insight. The logic of mysticism shows, as is natural, the defects which are inherent in anything malicious. The impulse to logic, not felt while the mystic mood is dominant, reasserts itself as the mood fades, but with a desire to retain the vanishing insight, or at least to prove that it was insight, and that what seems to contradict it is illusion. The logic which thus arises is not quite disinterested or candid, and is inspired by a certain hatred of the daily world to which it is to be applied. Such an attitude naturally does not tend to the best results. Everyone knows that to read an author simply in order to refute him is not the way to understand him. And to read the book of nature with a conviction that it is all illusion is just as unlikely to lead to understanding. If our logic is to find the common world intelligible, it must not be hostile, but must be inspired by a genuine acceptance. In our active life, where we have to exercise choice and to prefer this to that of two possible acts, it is necessary to have distinction of good and evil, or at least of better and worse. But this distinction, like everything pertaining to action, belongs to what mysticism regards as the world of illusion. In our contemplative life, where action is not called for, it is possible to be impartial and to overcome the ethical dualism which action requires. So long as we remain merely impartial, we may be content to say that both the good and evil of action are illusions. But if, as we must do if we are to have the mystic vision, we find the whole world worthy of love and worship, we shall say that there is a higher good than that of action, and that this higher good belongs to the whole world as it is in reality. In this way, the twofold attitude and the apparent vacillation of mysticism are explained and justified. The possibility of this universal love and joy in all that exists is of supreme importance for the conduct and happiness of life, and gives inestimable value to the mystic emotion, apart from any creeds which may be built upon it. But if we are not to be led into false beliefs, it is necessary to realize exactly what the mystic emotion reveals. It reveals a possibility of human nature, a possibility of a nobler, happier, freer life than any that can otherwise be achieved. But it does not reveal anything about the non-human, or about the nature of the universe in general. Good and bad, and even the higher good that mysticism finds everywhere, are the reflections of our own emotions on other things, not part of the substance of things as they are in themselves. And therefore, an impartial contemplation, freed from all preoccupation with self, will not judge things good or bad, although it is very easily combined with that feeling of universal love, which leads the mystic to say that the whole world is good. The hope of satisfaction in our more human desires, the hope of demonstrating that the world has this or that desirable ethical characteristic, is not one which, so far as I can see, a scientific philosophy can do anything whatever to satisfy. The difference between a good world and a bad one is a difference in the particular characteristics of the particular things that exist in these worlds. Ethical interests must remain in the background. Some kind of ethical interest may inspire study, but none must obtrude in the detail or be expected in the special results which are sought. The physicist or chemist is not now required to prove the ethical importance of ions or atoms. In pre-scientific ages, this was not the case. Physics, as it appears in Plato, for example, is full of ethical notions. It is an essential part of its purpose to show that the earth is worthy of admiration. The modern physicist, on the contrary, though he has no wish to deny that the earth is admirable, is not concerned, as physicist, with its ethical attributes. He is merely concerned to find out facts, not to consider whether they are good or bad. In religion, and in every deeply serious view of the world and of human destiny, there is an element of submission, a realization of the limits of human power, which is somewhat lacking in the modern world, with its quick material successes and its insolent belief in the boundless possibilities of progress. The submission which religion inculcates in action is essentially the same in spirit as that which science teaches in thought, and the ethical neutrality by which its victories have been achieved is the outcome of that submission. Human beings cannot, of course, wholly transcend human nature, something subjective, if only the interest that determines the direction of our attention must remain in all our thought. But scientific philosophy comes nearer to objectivity than any other human pursuit, and gives us, therefore, the closest constant and the most intimate relation with the outer world that it is possible to achieve. Scientific philosophy represents, though as yet only in a nascent condition, a higher form of thought than any pre-scientific belief or imagination. And, like every approach to self-transcendence, it brings with it a rich reward in increase of scope and breadth and comprehension. A truly scientific philosophy will be more humble, more arduous, offering less glitter of outward mirage to flatter fallacious hopes, but more indifferent to fate, and more capable of accepting the world without the tyrannous imposition of our human and temporary demands.